Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 25 million people in the United States who are of childbearing age now live in areas which have severely restricted or completely banned access to abortions, and that's according to the Associated Press. In the year since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, the historic Dobbs decision essentially handed access to abortions and reproductive rights to states, 25 of which have moved quickly to restrict access to abortions, while others already had laws waiting to kick in anticipation of the Supreme Court ruling. California, on the other hand, has codified access to abortions into the state constitution, along with passing other executive and legislative laws. Our state has also laid down the welcome mat for pregnant people across the country to come and seek reproductive care, no matter where they are from. So at the moment, the landscape over access to abortions is a patchwork of different laws and regulations. Joining us now to unpack where this all stands is Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at UC Davis, Lisa Ikemoto, an expert in reproductive rights. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Professor Ikemoto, you joined us about a year ago, and this immediately followed the Supreme Court's ruling. Now, according to the Associated Press, there's more than 25 million women and pregnant people between the ages of 15 to 44 who live in states where there are more restrictions on abortion access than there were before Dobbs. Was all of this expected, or have you been surprised by any of the laws that have been passed in the past year by states?
I've had, there have definitely been a few surprises. I mean, the overall trend of passing more bans, passing bans with very, very narrow exceptions, passing additional types of restrictions, such as additional gestational limits, those were not a surprise. I've been surprised at the creativity of the states that have stepped up to protect abortion rights. That's part of it. And then I think that one of the other surprises has been the use of what I'm thinking of as zombie laws. So, for example, several states in enacting their bans, rather than create new bans, or sometimes in addition to enacting new bans on abortion, have sort of called into play laws that were declared unconstitutional by Roe versus Wade and subsequent decisions. So, for example, Wisconsin has an abortion ban now in place because they revived an 1849 ban on abortion that existed before. Long ago, you know, over a century ago. So those types of efforts.
When it comes to California, I mean, we passed a law codifying it into our constitution. It was actually voters approved it last in November. But can what California is doing from an executive, legislative, or even in terms of like a proposition, like codifying it into the constitution, can this ever be threatened or superseded by federal law?
It's possible if there's a federal, if Congress passes a federal ban on abortion, for example, those could override our state laws that have been put into place to protect abortion access. I don't know that Congress will be able to get to that point, but that's certainly one risk for the state.
What are the biggest changes in California in the past year?
Well, you mentioned that voters passed a ballot initiative as a Proposition 1 as of November. So before that, California had constitutional protection for access to abortion, but they made a strong statement by putting in language that expressly includes reproductive rights, including abortion and contraception access. So those words are now clear. It's not just right of privacy. So they forestalled any possibility that the right of privacy could be reinterpreted by the state Supreme Court. It's clear that abortion and contraception are now constitutionally protected. And then during the past year, the legislature's passed a number of additional statutory protections, and there's a new slate of bills in place as well. So among the protections that were put into place were privacy protections that would that would prohibit California law enforcement, for example, from sharing private information with out-of-state law enforcement who might be investigating or prosecuting cases against their residents who've traveled to California for abortions, for example. So those kinds of privacy protections have been important. One of the other types of provisions is not just sort of providing sort of an abstract legal right, but actually providing a substantial amount of financial resources to enable access to abortion for people traveling to California. And that protects not only the people who are traveling to the state, but also people who currently live in California. So that abortion remains fully available to the people living here, or at least that's the hope.
And those are a lot of enhancements. Are there other states following in suit with California?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a whole block of states, maybe 20 states, who stepped up to expand protections for abortion access, and they are learning from each other, and California has been one of the leaders in that. And I think that will continue. As I said, there's sort of a slate of new bills coming up, and some of those will be implemented both in California and by other states as well.
So what I'm hearing is there's an opportunity for collaboration among states, especially if you're bordering each other. I would imagine there's California, Oregon, and Washington, which are more liberal, especially when it comes to reproductive rights.
Yeah, I think in the Northeast in particular, in the United States, portions of the Midwest and certainly the West Coast have created sort of zones of access for sort of comprehensive reproductive health care. Part of what's being done is expanding access to gender-affirming care as well, because one of the sort of trends that kicked up in the past year has been sort of using state power to restrict access to health care has expanded very rapidly to restrict access to gender-affirming care, in particular for youth. 20 bans on access to gender-affirming care or on providing gender-affirming care to youth have been passed. Very recently, 17 of those were passed in this year, 2023. And so California and other states are stepping up to provide sort of, again, sort of protection for access to and resources for access to gender-affirming care as well as abortion care.
You bring up a good point in that the Dobbs decision, although specifically it was taking on, you know, the right to abortion, it had other effects from a legal, political, and even social impacts.
Yeah, I think that the Dobbs case, it sort of, you know, sort of opened the door sort of from a state legislature perspective to, again, sort of, I guess, being creative, but also maybe expanding the sort of their ideological agendas, whether you see that as sort of pro-choice or anti-choice.
In the year leading up to the Dobbs decision, KFF, which is an independent source for health policy research, they found that, you know, healthcare for women, and I don't think that this is surprising, it's had a seismic shift in the last year, you know, 50%, and this is across the country, says that, you know, that there's patients who've been unable to obtain an abortion. Nearly half say they face constraints on their care, and nearly as many OBGYNs practicing in states with gestational limits on abortion also say they face such challenges in their practices. What impact does that have on states like California, which are willing to accept people outside of California to give them access to reproductive care and abortions?
Well, there are certainly a number of states that protect access to care, comprehensive care, that have experienced a greater number of patients traveling into those states to receive those forms of care that are restricted in their home states. Florida, for example, is one of those states. Illinois, certainly states like California, but the states that are sort of closest to the zone, the zone, right? What we have now have this zone of states that are banning access to both abortion and gender-affirming care, and just quality care for people who are pregnant. Those people are now traveling to states that are closest to them. And so you see that sort of influx. And again, you have the potential impact on the people who live in those states. Maybe it makes them a little bit harder to get an appointment And that's why states like California have dedicated not only just sort of legislation, but legislation that authorizes additional funding, even for things like transportation to clinics.
I mean, the doctor-patient relationship, it must have changed and evolved in the year since Dobbs, a relationship that typically is quite private.
Yeah, I think we've seen a number of effects coming into place. One is that doctors in states with these bans or substantial restrictions or very vague language describing the exceptions are sort of, they experience this dilemma between their professional duty and desire to provide evidence-based standard of care and the concern that they might be prosecuted or lose their medical license. So they're caught between sort of this rock and the hard place, so to speak, in those. And then the other kinds of effects that you've seen is that it's affected, there's already been a shortage. We've got a shortage in healthcare across the nation, all types of healthcare. We saw that most acutely towards the end of the official COVID pandemic period. And now what we see is that there's a national shortage in obstetrics and gynecology care. And it's affecting the medical residents who are going into that field of care, where they choose to learn. And some of them are choosing to avoid the states with bans on care. They won't get full training. They won't be able to practice medicine as they hope to be trained. Maybe, you know, one thing that some states, including California, are doing is trying to make agreements with medical schools in those states to enable those kinds of students to travel out of state so that they can receive adequate training, even though they're placed for their residencies in states with bans.
When you talk about this decision, the Dobbs decision, essentially kind of kicking the door open for people being creative with not only legislation, but also other lawsuits. I mean, there are outstanding challenges to even the use of some medication that is used in abortion, and that can have an impact on California. Where does all of that stand now?
Yeah, I mean, there was this case that was filed in Texas, the very strategic filing in a district in Texas where the judge is known to be very hostile to abortion and generally upholds abortion restrictions. So the argument was against the case was filed against the FDA, challenging the FDA's authority to approve mifepristone in particular. Mifepristone is one of the two drugs used in medication abortion, and medication abortion is used by maybe a slight majority of people who obtain abortions. So it's a very important medication. It's used for other purposes as well. So they challenged the FDA's authority. And one additional argument in that case was that the mailing of mifepristone, so delivering mifepristone and misoprostol through the mails, violated this 19th century law called the Comstock Act. So it's another one of those sort of zombie legal efforts.
Like from 1870,
that I
right?
mentioned earlier. Yes, exactly. The 1870s. It was an anti-vice law that was pushed by a man named Anthony Comstock, who was so worried that our country would be undermined by what he regarded to be sexual vice at that time, that he got a law, got Congress to pass a law that prohibited the mailing of anything to do with lewdness. And the statute mentions contraception and abortion. And the Texas judge discussed that law without saying no, it's been overruled or in a sense rendered ineffective by previous judicial decisions. And so there's still the possibility that that law could be revived. That judge issued a nationwide injunction on medication abortion or mailing of medication abortion. But that decision itself has been sort of administratively withdrawn by the Supreme Court, but we're still waiting to see what will happen in that case. It's not over yet.
When we think about the other uses for these medications that are typically on front of mind or connected to abortion, I mean, those medications also can be, and even some procedures are used during a pregnancy loss or a later term miscarriage, you know, situations when the life or the health of the pregnant person is at risk, or by not intervening with a medication or a procedure, it can create complications for future pregnancies if that person wants to get pregnant again. I don't think people really thought of that a year ago when this decision came down from the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's true. I think that many people who supported abortion bans didn't realize, probably many of us who oppose abortion bans, right, also didn't sort of fully imagine the wide scope of healthcare, particularly care, maternal care, that would be impacted by these bans, including the bans on medication abortion or efforts to restrict access to medication abortion. So doctors are stuck between the rock and the hard place with respect to use of that drug. It makes them look like they're performing an abortion, even though they're trying to help someone recover from something like a ectopic pregnancy or a miscarriage or some other condition. And then if a ban goes into place, people with other diagnoses may not be able to access that those drugs as well.
Finally, I mean, there still is some confusion over the Dobbs decision. I mean, just because, you know, it's been big national news, it doesn't mean every single person understands like the impact of it in the state that they live, especially if they live in a state where there are new restrictions to reproductive care. Like, I believe 1 in 8 people who live in states with abortion bans, and this is according to that KFF survey, they incorrectly believe that medication abortion is still legal, or more than half of residents are just unsure of what the legality of abortion is in their state. What do you think needs to be done, given that you're in the realm of academia, to bring more clarity so people just have more awareness of where things stand now?
It's hard to say. One is there is still going to be a lot of uncertainty, in part because some of the laws that have been passed have a lot of vague language in them. And some of the laws that were passed, it's not clear that they're fully enforceable. So several bans that have been placed are currently being held up in courts because of challenges that may be successful. So that's part of it. We'll never achieve perfect clarity in the law. And then the other part of it, it would be just the burden shouldn't fall exclusively on providers to help people understand sort of what care is available to them in their home states and what care is not available. Certainly public education efforts with accurate information is very, very important. Some states like California are stepping up to try to, there's a bill, for example, in the California legislature to improve the public's understanding of what care is available and how to get it.
Professor Ikemoto, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Lisa Ikemoto is a Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at UC Davis and an expert in reproductive rights. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Supreme Court weighed in on a more than 40-year-old federal law intended to protect Native American children. The Indian Child Welfare Act was created in response to a shameful time in U.S. history when Native American children were removed from their families to assimilate and, in turn, erase their culture and heritage. The Bureau of Indian Affairs found that prior to the federal law, which was passed in 1978, state and private agencies were removing as many many as 25 to 35% of Indian children from their families. But a case out of Texas challenged the constitutionality of this law, which raises a debate between tribal sovereignty and state law, as well as the rights of an adoptive parent versus a child in determining custody. In a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court ultimately decided to leave the Indian Child Welfare Act intact. Given that California is home to the most tribes in the country, to get a better understanding of the Supreme Court's decision, we're joined by Chief Judge Christine Williams of the Wilton Tribal Court. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Vicki.
So I started off with a general background, but can you remind us what the Indian Child Welfare Act, the ICWA, what it accomplished back in 1978?
What it accomplished was a recognition of tribal sovereignty. So the Indian Child Welfare Act allows or requires minimum federal standards to be applied in all state proceedings that involve child welfare, where an Indian child is involved. And part of that is to require notice to tribes to intervene in cases when they have a child in a state court proceeding so that they can express their interests, their wishes over their own children. To not do that, which was happening prior to the Indian Child Welfare Act, would be the same effect as to go to a foreign country and just steal a child and take them away to a foreign land. So the Indian Child Welfare Act prevents that. States cannot remove children, place them out of their homes without notifying the tribe and allowing the tribe an opportunity to proceed. There's also other minimum safeguards, placement preferences, requirements for efforts to reunify families and keep families together. Things of that nature that are really in the best interest of Native children and all children who are being considered to be placed and raised outside of their biological family.
And prior to this law's passage in 1978, I mean, that simply wasn't taking place, or there weren't parameters in place that impacted Indian children.
That's correct. Unfortunately, your statistics there show what this was looking like. I mean, up to 25% of all Native children were being removed from their homes and placed in non-Native placements. And it was really reflecting an institutional bias that was based on the presumption that all Native children would be better off being raised outside of their homes, outside of their communities, outside of the reservations, simply based on the fact that Native homes were seen as inferior. It really was institutional bias and racism that was at the heart of removing a lot of these children. And communities didn't know. There was no notice, no due process. So Native communities were just missing children and didn't know where they were.
This really wasn't that long ago. A lot of those people are still alive today. How have you and your tribal communities been touched by this?
I don't think there's a Native person who hasn't been touched by this. All of us have stories of family members who were removed, children that were taken to boarding school, which was sort of the precursor to the adoption project that really led to the wholesale removal of Native children to be placed in Native families. Like I said, I haven't encountered anyone that I know that doesn't have this story as a legacy in their family. It caused a lot of historic trauma, and I think we're still recovering from that as tribal nations and tribal people. But the Indian Child Welfare Act, I mean, it not only reversed a lot of these policies and the law provided hope, it provides tribes with this opportunity to exercise their sovereignty and make their wishes known for the best interests of their own tribal citizens.
Can you give us an example then in California how a child custody case works since the passage of the Indian Child Welfare Act?
When a child is being a child welfare proceeding is initiated by the state. So a state agency, which in California means a county. So a county is going to start a child welfare case under the laws that apply to abused and neglected children or the allegations of that for a child. Then if the child is determined to be a Native American child or eligible to be enrolled as a Native American child in their tribe, the Indian Child Welfare Act kicks in and requires those minimum federal standards. So notice, opportunity to intervene, the requirement of active efforts, the requirement of particular placement preferences for foster placements or adoptive placements, and then also the requirement of a qualified expert witness. And that's really to ensure that any any child welfare proceedings that are happening aren't based on that institutional bias, that they're actually based on a true need that's in the interest of the child, and not just that we think the child might be better off if we were to have them be raised in a non-native household. That's just not an appropriate standard to separate any family.
Okay, so let's fast forward to today, or at least in the last year. The Supreme Court case, it begins with this issue in the state of Texas, and it includes a birth parent as well as, I believe, a foster and adoptive parent. What was their argument for challenging the constitutionality of this law?
There was a lot of complex arguments being made, but what it really boiled down to is an argument which we now have affirmed is based on a myth that this that ICWA violates the Constitution, that it's a racial preference that's being applied in cases involving Native children. And it's been affirmed now more than once by the Supreme Court that ICWA is not based on race, but rather based on political status that Native American people have by way of being members of these sovereign nations. So we are nations within a nation. Because of that, there is a different status. So as I myself, I'm a tribal member in the Yurok tribe. I work for the Wilton Rancheria Tribal Court. I have dual citizenship in a way. I'm a member of the Yurok tribe, which makes me a citizen there, but I'm also a citizen of the United States and the state of California. So that is a political distinction, not a racial distinction. So that really was what was affirmed, which I think is just critical to tribal sovereignty. If tribes can't exercise jurisdiction and intervene in proceedings where their own children are involved, then they are losing access to what Congress deemed in the Indian Child Welfare Act as their most precious and valuable resource.
That you bring up
their children.
Yeah, exactly. And you bring up an important point, because although we're talking about children, I mean, a big argument to this case was tribal sovereignty, like versus state law. And obviously, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of keeping the law intact. But has a challenge like this been attempted before in, the 40 plus years that this law has been in place in our country?
Many times, many, many times. The Supreme Court, does not hear every challenge that they're asked to hear. And I don't have statistics on how many cases have made it up to attempt to hear a case at the Supreme Court.
But you're familiar with it.
I know at the state level how many times cases are challenged based on, my experience working as an attorney for tribes, working as a judge for tribes. Three different cases involving the Indian Child Welfare Act have made it to the Supreme Court since the Supreme Court, started hearing these cases. And each time there's been different levels of affirming ICWA. This one was, I think, if I have to pick a favorite, my favorite outcome, because it was so clear and affirming. And to me, really made the statement that the Indian Child Welfare Act is not based on race, it is not unconstitutional, and that hopefully the challenges really will stop at this point, so that we can all just get back to the business of protecting our most vulnerable children, which is all tribes want to do. So the tribal interests and the state interests really align when it comes to child welfare cases. We want the best for these kids. We want them to be protective, and we want all kids to have a permanent, safe, healthy home to grow up in.
In your view, then, do you think that this case made the argument of potentially like protecting an adult's rights in adoption cases, versus the welfare of a child and what's best for a child?
I do see that a lot. And as a tribal court judge, I deal with cases where I am asked to intervene, make placement orders, consider foster homes. And they're not easy decisions to make in any way. I understand how emotional people can become. But at the same time, people do seem to lose focus in some of these cases. The adults fight with each other over who has the right to raise this child or keep this child. forgetting that is, at least for me as a judge, what I'm interested in is the child's best interest, the child's right to grow up safe and healthy, and what that means for me in terms of having to protect that right. So I do feel that I see the adults making it a lot about themselves in these cases, when really it's about what's in the best interest of the child. And that premise, to me, goes hand in hand with tribes having a say in the case, because they are having a tribe as your, you know, your connection, that you're eligible for membership in this tribe, that you are a member in this tribe, that your parents are members in this tribe. That is permanency in and of itself. So to say that the tribe, you know, shouldn't be involved in these cases, I think it's really detrimental to Native children to cut off that sort of important branch of permanency for the child. They will always have that community, and they will always have that citizenship. And it brings not only a sense of identity, but sometimes really very real benefits for these children, tangible benefits, in addition to the cultural knowledge, the familial ties, all of which it can be lost if children don't have that connection with their tribe. And if tribes are excluded from state court proceedings, which was exactly what was happening prior to the Indian Child Welfare Act.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Chief Judge Christine Williams of the Wilton Tribal Court, discussing the U.S. Supreme Court decision, which upholds the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act. Okay, so this decision was earlier this month. The Supreme Court ruled in a 7-2 decision to keep this federal law intact. So I know that's a big sigh of relief. But in the months leading up to this decision, I mean, what was your level of confidence that this would be the outcome?
I was one of the most confident people that this would be the outcome, I have to say. I just really felt that justice would prevail. And, you know, I love being right. So it's a win-win. But in seriousness, I really felt that that the decision would be positive. I have to be honest, I didn't expect this level of affirmation of the existing Indian Child Welfare Act. I thought we might see some modifications or some, you know, kickbacks to states making some adjustments in their laws. So this is the best possible outcome. And I don't think I could have predicted this, but I was pretty confident that we were going to see a positive result. And I think it really is a testament to this Supreme Court makeup. I think the decision was well-written, it was unbiased, and it was fair, which is what I think as American citizens we expect from our Supreme Court. I felt it was not political, and it really just reflected the laws, the facts, and good judgment. So I couldn't be more pleased with that, especially since we do have a somewhat new makeup on the Supreme Court. I think we're all, as a country, still getting to know who these justices are and what their opinions are going to be. So if this is an indication of what we can expect for considerations involving tribes, I'm thrilled. I couldn't be more thrilled. I think it was fair and unbiased. And that's, as a judge, you know, the best you can hope for in any court proceeding.
Yeah, and that majority opinion was written by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who is, you know, among the newest to the court. When it comes to the dissenters, Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito dissented to this decision, and Justice Thomas's dissenting opinion, it includes some statements I just want you to respond to. I mean, one of the arguments that Justice Thomas makes is that the Indian Child Welfare Act often overrides state family law by dictating that essentially state courts place Indian children with Indian caretakers, even if doing so is not in the child's best interest. How do you respond to that as a judge yourself?
As a judge myself, I mean, with all due respect, I know how hard it is to make decisions. And I myself am wrong sometimes. And I just think that is a misstatement and mischaracterization of the law. for me, I really have been practicing in this field for a long time. I was the Indian Child Welfare Act attorney for the Judicial Council many years ago, and worked representing tribes in state proceedings involving Native children for years. And so with that level of experience and expertise, I can say that statement is inaccurate. The Indian Child Welfare Act does not favor Native American placements over non-Native American placements in the way that's being characterized. The placement preferences start with the child being placed with a relative. So if the child cannot be raised in the home where they were born, then the preference is to place them with a relative. It doesn't say Native relative. It doesn't say non-Native relative. It doesn't give any indication of what relative. It just says a relative. And that aligns with all of our federal, national level child welfare policy and law. So I just have to respectfully disagree. So in every case, we as a country, and Native Americans agree with this as well, would prefer to place children with family, which to me just makes a lot of sense. I think it's common sense, and was a little sad that we needed an act to make that a preference for Native children, because that's what was happening. They were being removed from their family and then placed in non-relative, non-Native homes. So I like to call that strangers. We were removing children from their families and placing them with strangers. And there was no evidence prior to the Indian Child Welfare Act that there was any efforts made to find suitable homes that were relatives. And that's, to me, what the Indian Child Welfare Act is about, keeping families together, having children being raised with their family whenever possible. Not to mention, there are good cause reasons that judges can consider to place outside of the preferences. If one of those to be considered, again, these are not absolutes, but examples of when a judge might go outside of the placement preferences that are illuminated in ICWA. One is there are no Native families available. There are no relatives available. There are no other tribal members available that can take this child. In that case, the judge can consider placing with a non-relative, non-Native American home, of course, because what else could they do? But there needs to be a good cause finding on the record of why, so that we don't slip back into that being the default because of institutional bias. It's a safeguard. So with all due respect to Justice Thomas, it's just an inaccurate, I think, uninformed statement about the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Chief Justice Williams, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
And that is Chief Judge Christine Williams of the Wilton Tribal Court discussing the U.S. Supreme Court decision this month, which upholds the Indian Child Welfare Act. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Sacramento is home to vibrant murals, but have you ever wanted to be part of creating one? Well, Here's your chance. A community paint day will transform a drab highway overpass into, you guessed it, bold, beautiful artwork. And all ages and skill levels are welcome. One of the creative forces behind this is artist Jaya King. She joins us ahead of the 21st Avenue Community Paint Day, and it is taking place on July 8th. It is located under the 21st Avenue underpass of Highway 99 in the city of Sacramento. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start off with your background as an artist here in Sacramento.
Well, I would say that as a transplant from the Bay Area, Sacramento has been just a wonderful transition and has welcomed me with open arms. This is really where I began my muraling and integrated that into my art practice.
What is this project about and how did you become involved in it?
This project is pretty epic. There was a call for artists for the 21st Avenue underpass, and my co-pilot Yuli Smith encouraged us to go for it as a team, and we got the project. This is a project that is funded by the Clean California Initiative, which is just a wonderful force for beautifying California, for cleaning up California. And so, yes, thank you. Thank you, Department of Transportation and Caltrans, for putting this out. The project itself is a community mural. Mm-hmm. The difference between community murals and other types of murals is this particular type of mural really integrates working with the community from design, conception, to actual creating on the wall.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes when people, especially in the city of Sacramento, they might think of like wide open walls when they think of the murals in downtown and midtown. But this is a community mural. It is off 21st Avenue, which is, you know, the overpass of Highway 99. For those who aren't familiar with that neighborhood, describe the community that's going to take part and also just get a front row seat to enjoying, you know, the artwork.
So the importance of this project is that it's really bridging the communities that were sliced by Highway 99. The South Oak Park community and North City Farms, along with the Franklin District, this is a way to reconnect them. So this is a project that I would say is a little bit more poignant than, say, a mural festival. That's one of the other differences. This is something that really connects with the community. The South Oak Park and North City Farms communities, if you could imagine, when being sliced by a freeway, there is a detriment. And the importance is that impact of connection and connectivity, and it can be a very transformative experience, especially for the younger generation, for the youth. There are two schools flanking the freeway, Ethel Phillips Elementary School as well as Oak Ridge Elementary, and the kids walk back and forth to school under the underpass daily. So this is something that can really change their I would say their impression of going to and from school, seeing, you know, a mural team putting up something that beautifies their community. This is something that impacts a generation in ways that we cannot foresee yet, but it really plants the seed.
Yeah, I mean, the meaning that I'm just learning from you, it has such a deep meaning and is so healing, and I can just feel the heart that you have put into this along with, you know, your colleagues who are artists. What went into visualizing and getting the inspiration for what people ultimately are going to create next month?
100% of the inspiration came from the community. My I call her my co-pilot. She's really my lead coordinator. As you can see, here I am sitting. Thank you, Yuli, for getting me here. She and I engaged with different neighborhood groups. We sent out surveys, and we got a lot of feedback from both sides of the freeway. That feedback I kind of filter through into a design. I consider color scheme. I consider inspiration. And of course, the overall message of the mural, which is something that is reflective of the community. And all of that is going to be executed, of course, by our team and inviting the community to come out and put their energy, put their vibe, put their brushstrokes on the wall, which takes this type of project much further than, say, just like a general residential, even a, you know, a festival. This is something that I particularly think is much more poignant.
Absolutely. I mean, I imagine children who are taking part in this and, you know, when they're adults and they have children and they go back to their hometown or they still live in their neighborhood, you know, they can remember, you know, what they put into this piece of art.
The comments that we get from the community members that have been around for a number of years where they've grown up in the community is they stop us and they say, hey, I remember walking this underpass when I went to school. My kids walk it now. And this is such an important part of what's going up in our community. They, I would say, have more of a connection and ownership to the project as well. And planting that seed in the younger generations is so important. And it's really it can be a watershed moment for the kids involved.
Yeah. It's, you know, the power of art, you know, to have a voice.
Absolutely. This is something that I think is also important, how I represent myself on the wall, how my team represents ourselves, and being a female forward team. You know, I personally have like a connection with, you know, expressing girl power in the community. And so there's a soft spot in my heart where folks are able to see, you know, a female led team creating something that is so transformative.
When collaborating with the community and having these conversations, what are some of the moments you've had that resonate with you?
I would say that the moments that always get me involve the kids. Mm-hmm. The moments that always get me involve the kids. And when I was just, you know, walking the underpass, checking out the area and seeing the kids walk to and from school, the importance of having something that would excite them, something that they would look forward to going through the tunnels, something that they get to say, oh, I get to see the butterfly. I'm going to go see the flower today. And they can see themselves on the wall. That's something that I would say is my number one, you know, that's my soft spot. I also had a wonderful conversation with a pastor at a local church and learned that he too was an artist. He was a metal worker. And one of his pieces, there was an inspiration from the way that he designed his piece that I wanted to have reflected in the mural as well. The feedback that I get, a lot of times I will not literally put in, say, oh, I want to see XYZ. I want to see literally this. However, I do take artistic license and interpret. So, you know, to be transparent, that if I say, hey, what do you want to see on the wall? They say, well, I want to see a big ice cream truck. I'm like, all right, well, let's, you know, let's see how that can work with the rest of the design. But ice cream truck might not make it, but I'm going to research all the different flavors of ice cream and maybe something like that can come in. So that's sort of the give and take with community engagement as well as artistic license.
When I think about the impact and how this can shape a community, we're talking about a piece of infrastructure that literally disconnected neighborhoods, right? And you have
exactly.
Children, you know, our youngest generation who are making this walk under the overpass. You have two schools that are really butted up to this overpass, and you're transforming it into not only a voice, but a piece of identity, which is just such a beautiful full circle moment for what happened.
I take that very seriously because this piece of infrastructure really sliced through the community, and the detriment that it caused is something that say other communities where the infrastructure is designed around does not experience. So having something that this community can own and feel proud of, I really have that in the forefront of my mind in the design process, in the execution, and really just making sure that connection is felt as widespread as possible, as well as educating and bringing light to the fact that this type of infrastructure can, you know, cause harm to communities.
Hmm. Finally, so if you have families listening, they want to take mm-hmm. part, it's not this weekend, but next week, and it's July 8th. What do you want them to know?
Oh, please, please come. Wear grubbies. Wear clothes that you don't mind getting paint on. There is nothing that is going to go on that wall that we cannot, take care of. So just really
elevate.
To elevate. We're going to have a some wonderful community resources. This project is under the umbrella of Caltrans, along with the Franklin Development Franklin Neighborhood Development Corporation. So we'll have a lot of resources about Clean California and basically how what you can reach out to with your communities. Mm-hmm. That we're going to have a food truck, XX Tacos. We're going to have some good music, good vibes. Really just come and enjoy yourself. Stay for as long as short you want. Put your brush strokes on the wall and just get your energy on there.
Yeah, paint party that last generation.
Paint party that's going to last.
Jaya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that is artist Jaya King, who is one of the creative forces behind the 21st Avenue Community Paint Day. It is taking place on July 8th. It is located under the 21st Avenue underpass on Highway 99 in the city of Sacramento. We have more information on our Insight page. And with that, that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.